So let me first announce that Kurt Dewhurst and I co-director Daily Worker Daily Lives. So it's wonderful to have Kurt here today, since we often do a la mon kind of responsibilities for our daily work. We have three March brown bags. So the first one is really interesting from the point of view that Ted McClellan just wrote a book called Midnight in Vehicle City, General Motors, Flint, and the Strike That Created the Middle Class. And no full treatment of the Flint sit-down strike has been written since going back to Sidney Fine's seminal work, Sit-Down, which was published in the 1960s. So it's really good that Ted decided to take it on. He's a journalist and writer in Chicago, originally from the Lansing area. So we're going to be happy to have him doing a brown bag on Monday, March 1st. There will also be a lecture that he's doing that night at the Ari Olds Transportation Museum here in town as part of our lecture series there. We added Jacob Zumoff, who's from the New Jersey City University in the East, who's going to be talking about the Passaic 1926 textile strike and the role of women and communism in that strike in his talk, Hell in New Jersey. And then on March 24th, Elizabeth Pfau comes back. Elizabeth is a major labor historian at Wayne State in Detroit, has done been department chair and has done a variety of things over the years, much of it focusing on occupational safety and health. And she'll be talking about occupational safety and health. All of those will be on Zoom. And if you're on my mailing list, you'll get those presentation Zoom links. Tonight, the Bomier Center up at, in the Upper Peninsula in Marquette and the Hiawatha Music Cooperative are actually doing a Songs of Labor concert. And that's going on with Robert Jones and Matt Wotoba. So you can actually get to that via the Bomier Center's Facebook link. And I will put all this stuff in the chat as we get started. Then tomorrow, Ann White from our theater department here at MSU will be talking about her research on actors' equity and very interesting stuff for the MSU Center for Interdisciplinarity. And I'll put that in the chat as well. So let me introduce Owen Clayton. Owen and I met in Kent at the Working Class Studies Association meetings last year. And it was wonderful to meet Owen, actually year before last. It was wonderful to meet Owen and to hear his presentation on T-Bone Slim. T-Bone Slim, as we were talking about, is one of those names that actually people think that they know. And they sometimes they don't know why, but they recognize the name. He's a senior lecturer in the School of English and Journalism at the University of Lincoln in the UK. He is working right now on a larger project on representation of vagrancy and homelessness here in the United States, which is headed toward a monograph on one side. And he's actually looking at a collection of T-Bone Slim, a volume of edited work of his work alongside that. So we'll hear more about that as we go along, but let me hand it over to Owen Clayton. And thank you so much to all of you to come to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. Owen, you can take it away.
Thanks so much, John. Thank you. Hi, everybody. So nice to see you, meet you. Thank you so much for the invite for this session. It's really an honor to be invited. So I'm going to hit share screen, and hopefully that my presentation will come up. So here we go. One second, share. Can you see that okay?
Yep.
Marvelous. Okay. We're all working. So hi from the UK. Hope everyone's well and surviving the current situation around the whole world. Yes. So, and probably should say on the sort of subject of sort of numbers, I've given papers to far fewer people than this in the past, although perhaps not quite such distances. I'll get going. So this is the title. Two things to say about this. The title I might not entirely live up to. That's number one. And number two, hope you appreciate, I went for the American spelling of labor and laborers there. I didn't put the extra U's in because you got to think about your audience, haven't you? I'll get going. So on the 15th of May, 1942. A corpse was pulled from New York City's East River. The body was that of Matty Valentin Poika Huta, a second generation Finnish American who'd been working as the captain of the river barge Casey. And the photograph you can see is of Pier 9 in New York City. Pier 9 is not there anymore, but that is where Slim's barge, the Casey, would set out from. And that's the East River where his body was discovered in 1942. If the camera was able to sort of pan magically to the right, you'd see the Brooklyn Bridge. So that's where it is. A committed member of the Radical Union, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW, or the Wobblies, Huta was better known under his pen name, which was also his hobo moniker. Lots of hobos had, assumed or road names that they went by, and his was T-Bone Slim. From the early 1920s until his death in 1942, Slim wrote hundreds of articles for radical newspapers, most commonly Industrial Worker and Industrial Solidarity, which were the IWW's main weekly papers. He also penned several songs, talk more about the music in the Q&A if people would like to hear more about that. And he wrote two longer pamphlets, The Power of These Two Hands, which is 1922, and a pamphlet called Starving Amidst Too Much, which is 1923. Slim was the most widely read Wobbly writer during this period. So the IWW actually printed adverts which asserted that, quote, T-Bone Slim has an article every week in Solidarity. And if you can see, if I zoom in, I think Prezi should let me zoom in. So hopefully that's working okay. You can actually see that they also say there is a lot more in Industrial Solidarity and Industrial Worker than T-Bone Slim's column. So basically it's like T-Bone Slim was their main selling point, but then they're saying, but there is more. It's not just T-Bone Slim. So he's clearly their biggest draw. So labor activist Stan Weir claims that hobos would write Slim's phrases onto boxcars, which would then give Slim's words, his writing, a kind of physical circulation as those boxcars made their way around the United States. Little wonder then that fellow Wobbly Harvey O'Connor referred to Slim as the laureate of the logging camps. But in the three quarters of a century since his death, Slim's name has been largely forgotten outside of his three most famous songs. And to be honest, not even there, they are necessarily that well known. The popular Wobbly is probably the most famous one. If people have heard of T-Bone Slim, it's usually because of the popular Wobbly. There's also Mysteries of a Hobo's Life and The Lumberjack's Prayer as well. But there are others, but they're the most well-known ones. And until very recently, no photographs of Slim had ever been published. In fact, until recently, it was thought that there were no photographs of Slim. But that's not, in fact, the case, as I will show you in a few minutes. In addition, aside from brief and isolated references to his songs, there is, or rather, maybe I should say there was, until an article that I wrote in 2019 now, that there was no academic scholarship on Slim for basically 75 years. So as Franklin Rosemont put it, T-Bone Slim won for himself a total exclusion from academic histories and textbooks of American literature. And Rosemont refers to this as a distinction legions of lesser writers before or since have found it nearly impossible to obtain. So nobody is talking, has been talking about T-Bone Slim. This kind of cultural and academic neglect would not have surprised Slim, who wrote frequently about the ideological nature of fame, which is something I'm going to talk about in the in this paper. So a quiet and apparently quite shy man, Hooter appears to have kept a low profile and only occasionally revealed his identity as T-Bone Slim to fellow workers and to friends. Most people who knew him as Matt Hooter or Matty Hooter. His columns, where he's writing under the name T-Bone Slim, reveals someone who had been a transient worker, a hobo, and was familiar with a variety of jobs, including a lumberjack, a Gandhi dancer, so somebody who would sort of tie down railroad ties and help construct the railroad, and barge captain, which was what he was doing at the end of his life. He makes occasional references to riding freight trains as well, so we know that he did that, which is, I suppose, the sort of stereotypical thing that hobos are known for. And before Slim adopted this lifestyle, this kind of transient lifestyle, we know that he'd been living with his young wife, Rosa, with whom he had had four children. And during this earlier period, he may have tried to work as an editor for a mainstream newspaper. There's quite a lot we don't know about Slim's biography. But if he did do that, it wasn't successful. What we do know is that in 1915, he left his family. He abandoned them for a life on the road. And he and Rosa were divorced in 1915. There's some stuff that we know about that. And there's some stuff that we don't, I think, know about that. But there is an opportunity, I think, for a kind of long overdue rediscovery and reevaluation of T-Bone Slim, of the laureate of the logging camps. Because unjustly neglected as a writer, Slim's work challenges the common mainstream stereotype of hobos, tramps and transient workers as kind of stupid, as brutish. And he does this through his writing has a kind of wit and a verbal dexterity that assumes intelligence in his transient working class audience. And he works to create a mode of literary genius that is kind of communal rather than individualistic. So that's one of the things I'm going to argue. So he uses a variety of literary techniques. He uses puns. He uses neologisms, which is basically he creates new words, in other words. He uses invented literary references, and he uses dynamic wordplay to provide an alternative to what he saw as a kind of bourgeois language that provided cover for class exploitation and encouraged a kind of reader and worker passivity. In contrast to that bourgeois writing, as he saw it, Slim's writing tried to force readers to think and to become active participants in his work. In effect, his prose embodies a kind of literary anarchism, which encourages the individual to play an active role in the process of making meaning. He also cultivates a persona, T-Bone Slim as a kind of literary persona, that plays with established notions of fame, power and success, which undermines the individualistic notion of greatness by connecting his greatness to that of his audience, which is something I'll go on to talk about. So Slim's persona is quite unlike that of other literary celebrities in that he repeatedly brings his body into the work, his kind of suffering body into the work, particularly through his representation of hunger, which I will talk about in the final section. And he portrays the class struggle class struggle as a conflict over care for the body, especially in terms of who gets to eat the best food. So kind of breaks down into three sections, really. The first section is about culture and language. So T-Bone Slim's coagulated verbosity. I don't know if anybody else needs to do this. I've kind of moved the screens of everybody else a little bit further over to the right so that the Prezi presentation can be viewed. If you've not done that, that's a tip. So this is the first section. So for Slim, bourgeois language, what he saw as bourgeois language, was a means to divide the working class amongst themselves. So in one of his newspaper columns, he discusses the connotations of the word unemployed. And he says this, quote, "Just why we call them unemployed is not clear, since the very word insinuates they had slipped the yoke, which, of course, they had not done," end quote. So Slim imagines the effect of this word unemployed on laborers who currently do not have work. And he adopts the attitude that one of these laborers who currently do have work, and he adopts the attitude that one of these laborers might then take to people who are unemployed, asking, quote, what right do they have to be unemployed while others must work, end quote. So the ideological effect of the term, the way that Slim is talking about it, is to create a kind of resentment among those people who are employed, who are led to believe that unemployment is a choice, and that unemployment is also permanent, and that therefore those people who are unemployed must somehow be kind of lazy and feckless. So he's talking about how the way that something is expressed is as important as what it says. So the connotations of particular words are as important as their denotations, are as important as their kind of literal dictionary definition meanings. So this notion, the idea that language has ideological connotations, runs throughout Slim's work. It's probably the thing he's most interested in. And there are several passages that are reminiscent of the work of Ambrose Bierce, in which Slim provides alternative dictionary definitions of words that seem harmless, but actually hold significant ideological weight. So these are some examples. So he defines profit as the price ignorance pays greed for the privilege of starving in a world of plenty. He defines tear gas as the most effective agent used by employers to persuade their employees that the interests of capital and labor are identical. And then he also defines charity as throwing a life preserver into a drowned man's coffin. Which are pretty kind of wonderful, pithy definitions, which I do really love. So these definitions kind of asking readers to kind of have another look, to look again at everyday terms that they may use and hear pretty often, and probably don't think about a great deal. So he's asking his readers to look at those words, those everyday terms again, and to see their true appearance as linguistic weapons in a war against the workers. So he's kind of, and the literary term for this is defamiliarization. So taking something that's familiar and making it unfamiliar, right? Defamiliarizing it. So Slim's defamiliarization of profit and charity frames these ideas in kind of negative terms as part of an exploitative system that provides the working class with starvation wages and then hands them a small and ineffective salve in the form of handouts. His reference to ignorance suggests that it is the false consciousness of the workers in not opposing the profit system that enables their exploitation. And his pithy description seeks to introduce these ignorant workers to the concept of surplus labor, right? And particularly through profit. In a different way, his definition of tear gas is aimed not at tear gas itself, because I don't think anybody would ever say that tear gas is a good thing, but rather at the widely accepted notion that, quote, the interests of capital and labor are identical, end quote, which he obviously thinks they're not. So he implies that workers who refuse to accept this idea, presumably by taking to the streets in strikes and demonstrations, are then met with violence and forced to submit. So there's a kind of lovely kind of understated quality to the tear gas one, right? That the use of the word persuade, it's a kind of euphemistic use of the word persuade. So commenting on his inability to read an Argentinian newspaper, Slim remarks in another article, he says, strange, isn't it, how words are meaningless unless given interpretation by the reader. This apparently innocuous question encapsulates Slim's approach to his writing. He seeks to make his audience into active readers through his literary style. And his most common technique to achieve this goal is by combining old words into new. So neologisms. I don't know how you would say that in the States, maybe the slightly different pronunciation. Usually these neologisms have an explicit political message, a technique that Slim refers to as coagulated verbosity. And in several attacks that Slim makes on mainstream newspapers, he terms the main banner headline at the top of a newspaper, he calls it headlines. So reading the headlines. So whether kind of aimed at generating a smile or a sigh, his neologisms ask readers to combine the ideas inherent in two otherwise separate words. unlike bourgeois writing, and Slim has a particular hatred for the work of Arthur Brisbane, who he has it in for quite regularly. He was a Hearst newspaper columnist, very conservative Hearst newspaper columnist of the day. So unlike that kind of bourgeois writing, such as that of Arthur Brisbane, Slim's writing, which is aimed at making readers passive, Slim's technique requires the active participation of his audience in order to create meaning. In addition to these sort of single word neologisms that are scattered throughout his prose writings, Slim also makes more extended plays on words that push the meanings of those words to their kind of limits of logic. So, for example, in critiquing a mainstream newspaper's claim that abundance means prosperity, so he says that he's read a newspaper that has said that abundance means prosperity. In other words, if a country's, I guess what we would call today GDP, if a country's kind of overall wealth is growing, that means that the people of the country themselves are also getting richer, right? So this is basically what this mainstream newspaper has said, with this idea that abundance means prosperity, and Slim disagrees with that, and this is what he says in response. Bring out your best type, Stumpy. We'll close debate. As there's shortage in these United States. Rather, it has been a case of too much abundance, and too much is not enough. Too much is too much, just what it says, and enough is less than too much. Too much is more than enough. And enough is never too much. Sufficiency isn't too much, but it is enough. So you can see yourself, enough is enough and too much is too much. Abundance is too much and not enough. Hence, it is a very ambiguous quantity to monkey with. Better stick to sufficiency, be it ever so elegant. So this passage consists of straightforward statements, such as enough is less than too much. Well, of course, enough is less than too much, right? Who could possibly disagree with that? And these straightforward statements define words and phrases. However, as these statements accumulate, the effect is to sort of question their overall meaning, even while their kind of standard denotations, their standard dictionary definitions remain in place. So the self-evidence of never has there been a shortage of abundance, and the tautological redundancy of it has been a case of too much abundance, combine to put the word abundance through a dialectical process that implicitly parallels Karl Marx's critique of capitalist accumulation. As somebody I read this to said to me, well, who needs Das Kapital when you've got this? which I thought was a really nice way of putting it. At the end of this process, the word itself, abundance, has become something new. Abundance is too much and not enough. So the paradox of capitalist abundance is that it simultaneously provides too much for the bourgeois class and not enough for the working class, meaning that it is a very ambiguous quantity to monkey with. So Slim translates dialectical materialism into comically absurdist language that aims to be accessible while not losing complexity. And that is really hard to do. Believe me, I've tried. The slang phrase to monkey with reminds readers of Slim's working class background and indicates that they too are able to realize the absurdity of starving amidst too much, which is the title of his pamphlet on the food industry. So this combination of working class dialect and absurdist wordplay is characteristic of Slim's writing. So the directness of Slim's language was a vital part of his political philosophy. Since his anarchism, and he was an anarchist, just to put that out there, depended upon a vision of laborers organizing society without the direction of political leaders, or at least minimal direction, his literary style had to use words that were comprehensible to the working class. And this was, he felt, in contrast to socialists and communists, he's actually very rude about communists a lot of the time, whose vocabulary, he says, was aimed at the educated vanguard who would lead the workers, rather than at the workers themselves. So one of Slim's articles picks up on a phrase used by this left-wing intelligentsia. He says, coordination of collective action is the big word Harvard boys slung onto the neck of the one big union. The one big union is the Wobblies, the IWW. You've got to be almost a contortionist to say it. However, it means the same as scat capitalism. So for Slim, scat capitalism is the superior phrase because it requires no linguistic contortions or presumably an Ivy League education to be understood. After having given one of his many pithy aphorisms, Slim comments that many have striven to say that and failed, else it took a column or half a day or a ton of words. So Slim privileges brevity and, like Oscar Wilde, utilizes the aphorism, the aphoristic mode, as the most direct and succinct means to convey complex ideas. So among Slim's aphorisms include, I don't believe there is necessity for a news censor. Editors have been very careful not to let any news get into the papers. That's one of my favorites. And then I think my personal favorite is the next one. Only the poor break laws, the rich evade them, which, you know, you kind of wish that wasn't still so relevant, but it feels like just as relevant now as when he wrote that. So both of these aphorisms begin with a statement that contemporary readers would have found surprising, but then proceed to kind of turn the statements around in kind of a witty and concise way to make a political point. Okay, so my second of three sections is about T-Bone Slim's persona, his kind of image, if you like, and also his representation of fame, power, and success. So Matty Hooter's persona, encapsulated under the hobo moniker T-Bone Slim, was the Wobbly newspaper's most successful brand. Like all brands, it had a trademark image. So this was the image that usually appeared at the top of T-Bone Slim's newspaper columns, particularly in the Industrial Worker anyway. His articles were typically accompanied by a cartoon drawing of a man with hair sticking up at the front of his head like devil horns and eating a T-bone steak. And this cartoon, people who knew Slim said was a good likeness. We kind of had to take their word for it until very recently. As I did mention that there would be some photographs. Oh, no, there's another cartoon actually from Industrial Worker as well. So this was a one-off cartoon, but you can see it's still supposed to be T-Bone Slim with the devil horns. And that's the death of capitalism. Capitalism is about to be hanged, and T-Bone Slim is kind of, and in fact, is about to be hanged from a T-bone if you look at the image. So kind of T-bone is being put to use there. I said there'd be some photographs. A few years ago found out that there were in fact some photographs of T-Bone Slim. So I discovered that there was an archive of T-Bone Slim's material for sale in a bookshop in Chicago. I told the Newbery Library that in Chicago that they should buy it, and they did, thankfully. So if you want to see some of this material, it's in the Newbery Library. So this is a photograph of T-Bone Slim, or Matty Hooter, as I suppose he was really. This is him as a young man before he becomes a hobo. So he probably looks a lot more sort of straight-laced than you might have imagined he is. This is him as a young, you know, a young kind of pre-radical, I suppose. I think he looks a little bit like Max von Sydow, personally, but that's just my own view. And that's Rosa, his wife. And that's him again. You can see there kind of is a bit of the hair kind of going up at the front, I think, like a little bit, a tiny bit. Not so much there. With one of his children. And then there are a couple of photographs that are in the archive of Slim's living relatives. These are a couple of photographs of Slim as a much older man. So probably does look a little bit more. So there's him on the left and the right, not the people in the middle, just to be clear. But there's actually another one, which is probably a bit better here of him. So this is a photograph probably taken, we think, in Erie, Pennsylvania. So this was basically in an attic. This material is basically in an attic of Slim's kind of current, living relatives, who had no idea who T-Bone Slim was until really recently. I mean, again, if people want to ask me about that, that's quite an interesting story. So I can, because we're working with one of Slim's relatives, who's actually a musician, who's making an album now, making an album of Slim's music. To go back to thinking about Slim's image. The cartoon, this cartoon that was at the front of most of his columns, kind of was supposed to encapsulate these kind of twin qualities of kind of rebelliousness and hunger that were key to Slim's persona, right? Because he looks a little bit like the devil, and he's obviously he's eating, and he's kind of constantly talking about eating, which is something I'm going to be talking, I'll mention. So Slim was well aware that his fame, such as it was, only existed in a relatively small circle of those who read wobbly newspapers. So Slim was kind of simultaneously well known and obscure. A kind of paradoxical situation that he folded into his persona through frequent comments on the nature of fame. So Slim asserted his fame in a way that is reminiscent of how Walt Whitman crafted his persona in his poems and through his poetry in the 19th century, and also through Walt Whitman's anonymous self-reviews. Unlike Walt Whitman, however, Slim's bombast, and you know, there's a great deal of bombast in both of them, but Slim's bombast is ironic, Whitman's isn't. So Slim uses a variety of kind of self-aggrandizing phrases, including, so where he refers to himself in the third person, he makes references such as, quote, T-Bone the Great, end quote, or, quote, the lustrous T-Bone Slim, end quote. And his most frequent self-reference is a variation of I, T-Bone, the, dot, dot, dot. And this self-aggrandizing, however, is undercut, usually, by the context of the particular article in which it appears. So to give an example, Slim refers to himself as I, the inimitable, immaculate T-Bone Slim, in a column in which he is forced to get a job as a dishwasher, or rather, as he puts it, to emancipate his future boss from the drudgery of the sink. And the trivial everydayness of this situation, right, of getting a job as a dishwasher, is, you know, in contrast to the deliberate pomposity of Slim's phrasing. So it kind of creates this kind of sense of the absurd a little bit, or kind of bathos. Similarly, Slim notes that there is a movement to buy Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, in order to preserve it for the nation. Okay, so that was something that was being discussed in the newspapers at the time. You should buy Monticello for the nation, preserve it for the nation. And so Slim asks in response to this news, he says, wouldn't it be a graceful deed if the IWW would purchase one of Fegg's brother's boarding cars, the home of T-Bone Slim, as a perpetual memorial? By the way, again, I request this be done after I am hung. So the image of T-Bone's, of the IWW buying a boxcar, so that's what he's talking about, right? Buying a boxcar for posterity is kind of humorous in its incongruity, and highlights the difference between a mainstream American hero, Jefferson, who lived in a mansion, and Slim, a prominent wobbly hero who has no permanent home. And the reference to Slim being hung, or I guess hanged, indicates that he is aware of the fate of wobbly heroes, unlike Jefferson, who, of course, was able to die peacefully in his sleep, surrounded by his family and his slaves, some of whom were also family. So Slim parodies the process by which ordinary people are idealized into heroes by imagining himself as a great leader. He grants himself enormous powers, as when he imagines arriving by plane to save a harvest crop from going rotten single-handedly after the other harvest hands have starved to death the previous year. And he repeatedly states that he is on the verge of running for the presidency, a manifestly absurd statement given the IWW's stance against voting. He claims to stand on a political platform of, quote, softer seats and rubber heels, end quote. And he says that he will not accept the vice presidency. It's president or nothing with me. And if it's nothing, I won't accept it, he says. He also states that he'd intended to run for mayor of Chicago, but was held upon the eve of nomination by slow freights, emphasizing the unlikelihood of a hobo being in a position to assume political power. So by making these preposterous claims, Slim parodies the system of representative democracy, and indeed the very notion, I think, of representative power itself. So as an anarchist, he sees the idealization of political leaders as leading to the anesthetization of the working class. Playing on his pen name, he tells his readers that, quote, no great, big, heroic T-Bone Slim or Dill Pickle Fat is going to prance into an industry and tell the children in the drill press department, quote, hear ye, I organize you, I now organize you into the yearnful earners of the universe. So, you know, he says, you know, I'm not going to come along and organize you. You have to organize yourselves. The mock heroic language highlights the pomposity of political leaders who assume that they can do easily for the workers what the workers have been unable to do for themselves. Such leaders are dangerous as they mislead their followers and potentially become demagogues themselves. Can't imagine that happening today, right? by the way, Yearnful Earners of the Universe is a kind of parody of the medievalism of early craft unions, which often have these kind of almost medieval sounding names. Flynn connects his own greatness directly to that of his readers. He's stating that, quote, "No one recognizes better than T-Bone Slim the insignificant magnitude of the world's greatest writer. A man is only great as a writer if his readers are great. Never was, is, or will be a writer greater than reader." So Slim's greatness is an insignificant magnitude if considered on its own. Rather than a quality of individual genius, greatness is a relationship between the writer and reader. It is a communal quality, in other words. Okay, so I move on to my third and final section. Empty stomach is the revolution, hunger is class struggle. So for Slim, revolution was a conflict over care for the body. So he refers, with kind of typical gallows humor, to sleeping rough. He says, "Woke up stiff all over, lumpy bed. I had inadvertently spread two sheets of newspaper in one spot." So the dark comedy, which here comes from the reversal of expectations in the second sentence, helps to identify Slim with his audience, emphasizing that, like them, he lives in harmful conditions. And when I've sort of talked about Slim in other places, someone sort of in the Q&A said to me, "Yeah, but he's not really doing that, right? I mean, this is just a persona. He's putting this on." Well, actually, no, he's not. Not entirely. I mean, yes, it is a persona, but he also did sleep rough at times, you know, like a lot of hobos did, you know, and he would sleep in missions as well. He was genuinely poor for his entire life. So it kind of is a persona, but it's also based in reality, I guess. So the search for food is the most common theme in Slim's work. It is a search that is deeply political, being tied to the unequal distribution of wealth. So for Slim, the empty stomach is the revolution, the only kind workers have ever known. And he noting that, quote, "labor has a bad habit of getting hungry," end quote, he claims that in seeking political change, the working class merely wishes to continue what he calls, quote, "the noble custom of eating." He makes frequent reference in numerous articles and in his unpublished notes to ham and eggs. Along with the T-bones that give him his name, this is the most commonly cited food in his work, ham and eggs. And ham and eggs become kind of shorthand in his work for a simple meal that workers deserve and desire, but which they are not getting. And indeed, so prominent does this particular meal become that when Slim writes a 1924 column as the parodic opening of a romance novel, he calls the lead character a well-to-do gentleman. He calls the lead character a well-to-do gentleman, Mr. Hammond Eggs. And this Dickensian naming strategy literally embodies food into the person of Mr. Hammond Eggs, whose name expresses the fact that as a member of the bourgeoisie, he is able to access good food easily. With the exception of Mr. Hammond Eggs, however, Slim's focus is usually actually on the lack of food and the consequent importance that it takes in the everyday life of the poor. So mealtime, as he puts it, is an epoch in the history of today. And the daily experience of hunger is for Slim a defining class experience, dividing working class consciousness from that of the bourgeoisie. And this is why he writes referring to an article he's just written. Humor in the above is very delicate. To appreciate it, skip a couple of meals before reading. So if you're not hungry, you won't really appreciate my humor, he's saying. So his writing cannot be appreciated by those whose bellies are full. So The other thing about Slim, I'm sort of come to my conclusion in just a second. The other thing about Slim in terms of the way he talks about food is the other thing that concerns him is not just people not getting enough food, but also people getting bad quality food. And he talks quite a lot about the quality of food. The Lumberjack's Prayer is all about that. In fact, his song, kind of poem song, about is all about eating sort of really bad processed hot dogs and things like that. And he's saying that, you know, that eating that food, he says that food ruins his guts. And what he wants is kind of proper real food. And Slim was a cook as well. I mean, should probably add that in terms of his biography. We do know that. Okay, so I'll move to my conclusion. So some people have speculated that Slim became an alcoholic towards the end of his life, and also that he was actually murdered. Both of these claims, I should say, are unproven, but it is certainly true that his final years were quite difficult. So he appears to have suffered some kind of legal trouble. They've done research in the municipal archives in New York City and managed to find a reference to Slim being arrested for disorderly conduct in 1939, but he doesn't give the authorities his real name. He also doesn't give his authorities the name T-Bone Slim. He actually gives them the name Joseph Hilger. So it's basically a reference to Joe Hill, and he sort of gives the name Joseph Hilger, I think, partly because he doesn't want to tell them his real name, partly because he sees himself as basically the new Joe Hill. And I think partly it's a bit of a joke as well at the authorities, because he's kind of having it, although they've arrested him, he's having a bit of a laugh at their expense that, you know, he knows that that's not his real name, and he knows that it's a reference that some people will get, some people who know who Joe Hill is, and some people just won't get, and it doesn't look like the municipal authorities in New York got that reference. So he had some kind of legal problems. There's also a reference in a letter where he's crying, and this is in the archive, the Westmoreland Family Archive. He's crying and he's talking about an upcoming court case as well. We don't really know what that court case was, but he seems to have been very upset about it. He seems to have at least partially fallen out with some of his publishers as well, with the editors of Industrial Solidarity, I think possibly over his... He took an anti-war stance to World War II, which was not the stance that most Wobblies took. So I think it may have been a little bit of a falling out. Also, he suffered ill health a little bit and had sort of workplace injuries. And his column dramatically fell off in terms of it's the number of times it was being published. So his columns had kind of run pretty consistently, pretty much every week, sometimes twice a week in new IWW newspapers since the 1920s. And all of a sudden in 1941, they sort of failed to appear. Or at least very erratically. So between July 1941 and his death in May 1942, his articles appear in only 6 out of 45 issues, which is a pretty dramatic kind of fall off. If anybody wants to know the sort of story about, you know, was he or wasn't he murdered, I can talk about that in the Q&A if you'd like to know more. So to just summarize, to finish off, as I hope I've shown, T-Bone Slim was a gifted writer whose contribution to American literature has been unjustly overlooked. His verbal dexterity, wit, and surrealistic style were unique in the radical newspapers of the early to mid-20th century, or maybe I should say extremely unusual. As such, his neglect by literary scholars has been pretty remarkable, I think. As well as being of interest to kind of future, you know, literary scholars and labor historians, it seems to me that Matty Hooter's commitment to the cause of working class emancipation could provide inspiration to many activists and writers who seek social justice and greater equality in our own time, and also artists. And in fact, there is a Finnish artist called Antti Mänivali, probably not pronouncing that right, sorry Antti, who's been inspired to still create some artwork in Finland about T-Bone Slim just in the last couple of years. So that the process has started to happen a little bit. And I'll just finish with a final quote from T-Bone Slim. As T-Bone Slim put it, "To make two blades of justice grow where none grew before, that is beauty." Okay, thank you very much for listening. I will stop sharing my screen now.
Great. Well, Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear it again, Owen. So quite interesting. Just a quick note for those who might not know Joe Hill. Joe Hill, of course, was the original poet, songwriter, and very famous agitator for the industrial workers of the world, shot for supposedly the charge of murder in Utah in 1915. So when T-Bone Slim is invoking him, that's the invocation, in effect, of what he's doing. So let me open it up for questions. I've got plenty, but if folks want to start, please just jump in. Any questions? Nice to see you, Carl. Good to see you here. Well, let me actually mention one question. You know, I have to admit, putting two articles in the IWW newspaper on a weekly basis, that's a lot of writing. Mm. But how did he actually get it to them? That is, was he walking it down to the office? Was he dropping these in the mail? What was the way that an author would actually make sure that he was in solidarity or the industrial worker?
Sure. It's a really, really good question. And I suppose the first thing I'll say is there are a heck of a lot of gaps in his biography. We know, very, very little. The most that's been written about his biography, if people are interested, is in this book, if you can see this, which is called Juice is Stranger Than Friction, which is the one collection that does currently exist of T-Bone Slim's writing. Franklin Rosemont was basically who edited this book. You know, huge credit to him. He kept T-Bone Slim, torch going when no one was interested in T-Bone Slim at all. Sadly, Franklin's not with us anymore. So there's some biographical information in there. There's a few more things have come to light, kind of subsequent research that I've done and partly in conjunction with the Westmoreland, the Slim's current relatives. In terms of what we know about how he got the material to the newspapers, it appears to have been sometimes in person when he was there to do it. So there are accounts of him going into the headquarters in Chicago and literally just giving his notes to whoever happened to be the editor, and the editor seemed to change pretty regularly. Sometimes he seems to have posted it, as far as I can tell. He also makes reference to, because he was a transient worker, so there are some articles in which he is in the Midwest, and he talks about going to like the local IWW headquarters in Kansas, if he happens to be working in the harvest in Kansas at a particular point. So he seems to sort of take his writing to wherever the local IWW headquarters is, whenever possible. So that appears to be how he did it, as far as we can tell.
Okay. Other questions before I go forth with questions? Carl, you have to unmute my phone.
I'd like to thank Owen, because we've been in correspondence about T-Bone Slim as a musician.
We have,
hi. Finnish American musician. And I really appreciate the source materials you sent me, because he really has quite a lot of songs there that were published. We don't know what the tunes are that he sang those songs to, but he published a lot of different songs. And oh, they're funny. They're really, really hilarious and lots of fun. And I just wanted to thank you personally. And I loved your presentation. Sorry, I was a little bit late here. I had to take care of some business, but I have a question for you. I've been trying to ferret out his Finnish connection, and I was able to find in various places, and I know that it's pretty well documented that he attended that IWW hall in Finnish Harlem, and that has been documented. But what I'm interested in is his connection to the Work People's College in Duluth. That's the really important one. Now, I did get a newspaper clipping from a Finnish scholar showing that he was in Duluth at a particular time, and that he was performing at it was the beginning of that newspaper Industrialisti, that was like the fifth anniversary or something, and the person who came and performed was T-Bone Slim. Do you know of any other connections with the Work People's College, which of course was a Finnish IWW college there in actually it wasn't in Duluth, it was across the river in Superior, as I recall. Yeah, I stand corrected. I'm with a bunch of historians and they'll correct me anyway.
Well, first of all, it's so lovely to see you, Carl. Yeah, I put a face to a name. Hi, it's really thank you so much for coming and listening to this. I'm also a little bit scared when I'm in rooms with historians as well, to be honest, because I'm not a historian. There's to be honest more research that I need to do and intend to do about Slim's biography, because I've mostly kind of focused on the writing, but there's definitely more that I need to do about the biography. In terms of the Work People's College, it is certain that he went there. Yeah, he absolutely went there as a student. For sure, because he talks about it in several articles. Like this is, he mentions, and he's almost a bit of a booster for the Work People's College. A number of his articles mention it. And he does talk about going there, and he talks about being educated there. I think I was aware of a reference to him kind of going back there as well. What I don't know yet, still to be uncovered, unless anybody else can help me out, is exactly when he went. He abandoned his family in 1912. The first time he appears in print is 1920. There's a bit of a mystery about what he did in those years. I mean, presumably was a hobo, I guess. I would think that was the period in which he went to Work People's College. I need to follow up with them, to be honest. I had a little bit of communication with their archivist, because they do have some photographs of students, their attendees over a number of years. I don't think they actually have lists of names. But they do have photographs. They sent me one, and I did have a kind of zoomed in and peered to see if I could see somebody who looked like what T-Bone Slim looks like from the photographs that we have, which as you've seen are not many. And he wasn't in the ones they sent me, but they had others that I haven't followed up with yet. But yeah, he definitely went to Work People's College for sure as a student, and it seems to have really influenced him. There's one article where he talks about being introduced to the IWW in 1916. How accurate that is, I don't know. I guess we just kind of have to take his word for it. But it could very well be that's the year, or maybe shortly thereafter, that's when he started, when he went to Work People's College.
Other questions or comments that folks have? Again, I have a number.
I was going to mention to Owen that the source material from Superior there, the TUMES Society, which is the Workers' Society, all those papers and music and other things went to the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota.
Yep.
I've done probably 5 trips there and haven't even come close to going through the materials that are there, but they're very rich in music scores, and maybe there is something there, in the newspaper clippings or something else that might help you. I'm just saying that's where that stuff is today. It's not in Superior anymore.
And I've used it as well, Carl. And it's a wonderful collection for anyone interested in especially in Finns, in terms of immigration. But obviously they cover the waterfront there. But the Finnish collection is unbelievably strong.
Yeah, and it's in the Elmer Anderson Library, and they do offer stipends for going there to study their materials. And I've been a happy holder of the stipend maybe 2 or 3 times. So let me, I know you'll, don't go there in the winter. I did that once in January. And it was extremely cold to walk that mile from my hotel to there. But in the summer, it's quite nice, but that's where the material is.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you so much, Carl. I really appreciate that. I may ping you an email at some point, but I've made a note of that. Thank you. That's really helpful.
Other questions that people have? Let me raise one just because other people might not know. The Popular Wobbly as a song, the title is not as well known as the actual refrain, where they go wild, totally wild over me. And it's this idea that he's popular with the cops, and he's popular with other people because they simply go wild over him all the time. And it's probably one of the best known non-Joe Hill songs that there is in the entire IWW kind of songbook. Let me raise one question with you, Owen, and others might be interested or want to chime in as well. Often the idea of the industrial workers of the world is a hobo army, that is, that this was a group of people who would travel transiently across the United States on the rails as you were laying out. I think that Utah Phillips, at times the most famous until his recent death, kind of singer of the IWW songs and keeping that alive, really would talk about this whole notion of the fact that many of the hobos only worked long enough to get food and then would continue to be transient. So this goes against kind of your earlier unemployed versus employed, quote that you were taking from T-Bone Slim. Because I think that Utah would probably say that as the idea of that hobo often simply wanted to travel, mostly men who did not necessarily want full-time work. That is that they did not have a love of that whole grounded kind of being part of the labor force. Would you comment on that whole notion?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I'm writing a book about, it's called, Vagabonds, Tramps and Hobos. It's, the literature and culture of American transiency is the kind of rough working title. And so I've been thinking, more broadly than just T-Bone Slim about that question. One of the significant things that happens with the term hobo, which, seems to emerge in the late 19th century, seems to emerge in the American West, and it seems to be partly a way of differentiating certain kinds of workers from tramps. And there were a series of tramp laws in the late 19th century, which you could basically be arrested for vagrancy. And so tramp was a kind of legal category. Hobo, and it's a, all these are obviously discursive terms. So they, we have to be careful not to think that they mean exactly what people say they mean, that they're kind of slippery. But the way that what happens in the early 20th century with that term, so it first just becomes, it's often just first of all used as a synonym for tramp. So for the most famous example of this, people might be familiar with possibly, is Jack London's book, The Road, in which he uses hobo and tramps just pretty much, like synonymous. He doesn't really kind of consider them as having a difference. He actually gets picked up on that by someone who writes to him, interestingly. But basically in the sort of 19 teens and into the 20s, there's an organization called the International Brotherhood Welfare Association, or the IBWA, which was a kind of slightly less radical but still pretty radical version of the IWW in some ways. And they ran hobo colleges around the US, particularly most famous one being in Chicago, which is a kind of place where people could get accommodation but also education for transient workers. And what they basically promoted was the idea of the hobo as a worker. So I think, and don't get me wrong, I'm Utah Phillips is one of my heroes. Probably wouldn't be doing this without Utah Phillips. But I would say that the idea of work became essential to the hobo identity, at least the version of the hobo identity that was being promoted by the IBWA. And it becomes, so there's this kind of fight over what the word means, basically. The IBWA, there's the kind of famous quote from Ben Reitman that they use, which is the hobo works and wanders, the tramp dreams and wanders, and the bum drinks and wanders. So it's this kind of hierarchy of workers. And basically the hobo is superior because they are a worker, which is not to say that every hobo felt like that. But that was a kind of prominent, quite influential among the hobo community idea. So I think work was quite important.
Well, and just to use the refrain from the song, Hallelujah, I'm a Bum. Mm. Hallelujah, I'm a bum, bum again. Give me a handout, revive me again, right? So this whole notion of, and that was a very heroic, self-referent song by the IWW at that time, but enough of that. Other questions, just to
jump in on that, the IBWA had a newspaper called the Hobo News, which if people are interested, it's now been digitized. It's on the St. Louis Public Library, the website of the St. Louis Public Library, and they actually cite that song, Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, but they change the words, so they change it to Hallelujah, I'm a Hobo. And the reason they do that is because they're trying to promote the term hobo over the terms bum and tramp.
Yeah. Other questions or comments that people have? Questions or comments?
Would it be worth me putting a link to the podcast that I was involved in?
Yeah, that'd be great.
If people are interested, so I'll just put the link to the podcast. So the podcast that I was involved in is about T-Bone Slim, but it features not just me. So if you're fed up of listening to me, it also features John Westmoreland, who, as I mentioned, is one of Slim's relatives, who is working on an album of Slim's music, much of which, and Carl, I know you'll be interested in this, much of the music that's going to be in that album has never been recorded before. And quite a number of the lyrics were previously unknown, and if they were published, they've not been republished since the sort of 20s or 30s, and some of them have never been published because they come from a kind of personal archive or letters that Slim wrote that were never published. So if you're interested, Carl, in that, check it out.
Carl, one thing for you, and Owen might want to comment on that as well. My assumption is that the various other T-Bone Slim songs very well may have been, not unlike Joe Hill songs, put on top of, frankly, religious songs or other popular songs of the day. So can you, as a musicologist, is it possible to look at a song and understand what the rhyme scheme might be in terms of the songs that they could have been based in, or is that virtually impossible?
Well, it's actually not very hard at all. I looked at the songs that Owen sent me, and I was just having so much fun with that. I mean, what a clever guy. So one of the ones that I picked, that I decided, and I'm writing this book on Finnish American music and musicians. So I just finished up the workers' music chapter. And it's the longest one, of course, in there, because there's a lot of workers' music stuff on, especially among Finns. And T-Bone Slim had to be in there, but we didn't know a lot about that. So I figured I could pick the lyrics of one song, and the one I picked was, "It Ain't Gonna Rain No More, No More," where he makes fun of the kings and the aristocracy, and it goes on for about 7-8 verses. And you know that it's sung to that popular song, which was sheep music, probably late 19th century sheep music, which became extremely popular, a children's song. Mm. And he does not say anywhere in that article, sung to this tune. Mm. But the second you see the lyrics, you know it can't be any other tune. It's got to be that tune. So that's the one I chose, simply because it was so damn clever. I mean, you know, the guy really knew how to put words together in such a way to slap you in the face, you know, to say, hey, wake up, this is what the real world is like. You know,
Yeah,
Owen, have you heard anything recently from John Westmoreland? How is he coming along with the album and so on? I know that he was, he's a performing musician, and all performing musicians have been basically dormant this whole last year. We can't go out, we can't perform because, there's no live music, there's no restaurants to play, and there's all of that it's a nightmare. But, he could get into the studio and do that. And I'm just waiting here very anxiously just to hear his recording, because I think it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to anyone who's interested, John Westmoreland, if you just, Google him, he has a website and he has a YouTube channel as well. There are a couple of recordings of live performances and things like that of him doing some, including some songs that, that have never been recorded by anyone else. John is an extremely talented musician. It was kind of ridiculous when I realized that the only other person in the world who was interested in T-Bone Slim a few years ago was his great grandnephew. And not only was his great grandnephew had just literally a few months previously discovered that he was related to T-Bone Slim, who the family had kind of forgotten about, and also happened to be this really brilliant musician who was like, I'll make an album. I think the album has been delayed because of COVID. And as you say, with restrictions on performances and recordings and stuff, but I would imagine it's going to probably come out this year. He sent me some draft versions, if that's the right term for songs, and they sound great. I think they're going to be great. People should definitely watch out for that. And I can't wait to read your book as well, Carl.
Well, it's still pretty rough, but I want to say, musically speaking, because I have this, we build these silos when we're in academia.
Yep.
And other people are working on things that are fantastic, just absolutely what we need to look at. Well, in the musical world, the silo is they don't know T-Bone Slim because he gets confused with T-Bone Walker.
Yeah.
The blues singer. Yeah. So when you talk about that, they don't know anything about T-Bone Slim and his backstory and all of the fascinating, not just the music and so on that he wrote, but a real cogent writer. And I love the direction you're going. How is your book coming along on that hobo culture? I think that would be a fascinating book to see.
It's getting there. I've got kind of draft versions of every chapter, and I'm going to basically spend the rest of this year making them good, and then hopefully it'll come out next year is the hope. Anyway, fingers crossed.
Well, I just want to do two quick things. One thing is, for those of you who aren't Finns, since Carl and I happen to have that as a common bit of background, one reason that T-Bone Slim makes sense is because Finns, as an immigrant group to the United States, were more literate than almost any other group that came to the United States already pre-existing as literate before they came to the US. And they were Finnish radical halls were replete with large libraries in Finnish of all of the classics that you would imagine. Let me again invite everyone to come back on March 1st for Ted McClellan talking about his work on the Flint sit-down strike. And Owen, I can't thank you enough, especially since you're frankly an ocean away and on a totally different time zone, to say the least. So thank you for being part of our daily work, our daily lives. And thank you to all of you. And please do come back. If you haven't put your email in the chat, please do. And we'll be in touch. And I hope that you found this to be as interesting as I did today. Thank you so much, Owen.
Thank you so much for inviting me, John. And thank you so much to everybody for listening. It's been a genuine pleasure to be a part of this. Thank you. And I'm hoping to get to a lot more of these myself as an audience member.
Right. Okay. And for you, for us, it's a lunch brown bag. For you, it's a dinner date.
Yeah, right? Exactly. It's till 6:20 now. So this works well.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thank you all. And we will see you soon.